Hello everyone, my name is Francis Donald and I'd like to welcome you to this 11th session in an ongoing series of webinars on sacred number and geometry. If you'd like to view any of the first 10 sessions, they are available on makara.us, that's makara.us, thanks to Brett Mitchell, who's also with us today assisting, as is BL Allison, and thanks to you both. Okay, I'm going to skip to the interface part of this because I think most of you have been with me long enough that you've got a handle on that. If you are new and you would like to know more about how to use the little control panel there, use the text box to text BL. Here, I'll run back to that part. It's right there. And just ask any questions you might have. BL will get back to you on that. Okay. Welcome to our fourth and final foray into the realm of fourness. We spent last month's session considering the philosophic implications of the point, the line, the surface, and volume, the elements that make up every 3D figure. Then we applied DK's three-step analysis to the cube and ended the session with a discussion on the key role that the fourth subplane of each plane plays in our evolutionary process. So I'd like to start today's session by taking a look at the four directions. This seems straightforward. Francis, yeah.
I'm sorry. You have a comment here from Asha, and I just wanted to get it to you before you get too far into your thing.
Okay, go ahead.
She says, with reference to the opening quote, in the oneness, if one does create for oneself, then one is creating for the world too, perhaps. As I am lifted up, all life is lifted up. The butterfly effect. If you create for one precious electron of life, then don't you create for all. The universe works win-win surely. Am I not also God? I understand a lower level of selfishness versus selflessness, but the individual I am is part of God in the oneness. Any comments from you concerning this? She says, well, she's not arguing with DK.
Well, that's probably a good tack to take. Creation and the creative element is a major part of the fourth ray, and it's also what allows us to align and identify with that which we call spirit, whether it be in the guise of soul or monad or Godhead or whatever. And therefore the sense of being one with the Creator is really gained through creation. When we create, we become one with the Creator because we identify with that process. So that's my comments on that. Thank you for that. Very thoughtful ideas. Okay, so let's get into the four directions. This seems a straightforward enough study until we discover that esoterically understood, north, south, east, and west are only symbols for a much more profound reality. DK tells us, and I'd like to break the ice and get a reader in for this, if we could. Somebody like to volunteer to read this.
Go ahead, Malia.
Hi, Malia.
Hi, Francis. Hi, BL. One moves upwards into kingdoms hitherto unseen and unknown, downwards into kingdoms which we call subhuman, outwards into the human environment and into the human kingdom, and inwards, a meaningless word, my brother, toward divinity itself. This means towards synthesis, towards wholeness, towards the sense of the entire, towards totality. For all these four directions, of which north, south, east, and west are symbols, there are specific techniques, but today I may only indicate direction.
Thanks, Malia. Okay, DK also tells us, and by the way, this isn't a video, that the planes rotate from east to west, and the rays rotate from north to south. Though again, he hastens to add that these are not movements in three-dimensional space. Through the interaction of these four directions, the work of the four Maharajis, or Lords of Karma, is made possible. The quaternary and all sum totals of four can be seen as one of the basic combinations of matter produced by the dual revolutions of the planes and rays. Now, this is a revelatory statement. The all sum totals of four can be seen as one of the basic combinations of matter produced by the dual revolution of planes and rays. And since he tells us that the planes move in an east westerly direction and the rays move in a north to south direction, you can see that this is very much connected with the four directions. We can surmise from this statement that the dual rotation of the rays and planes is the force responsible for driving spirit into matter, or the lower quaternary. And since two of these directions actually represent inner to outer movement, we have in this movement of the rays and planes a description of a wheel turning on itself. This is corroborated in Letters on Occult Meditation, where we're told that turning inward or within is a fourth dimensional movement, a movement described in the Bible as a wheel turning upon itself. We have a much more detailed account of this phenomena in the stanzas of Zion, the ones that appear in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. In stanza 3, we're told, "The great wheel turned upon itself. The seven lesser wheels rushed into being. They revolve like their mother, around, within, and forward." Now, could this great wheel be the cosmic physical plane itself, that which moves east and west, and the seven lesser wheels each of the seven subplanes? Other stanzas and the stanzas of Zahn seem to suggest this. And if that's so, could the fourth ray on one hand and the fourth subplane on the other be the dual axes of this great wheel, axes that form the arms of a great rotating cross? Remember, the fourth subplane is the midway point, with three above and three below. Now, if we extend the short arms of the mutable cross, which is depicted here, we have the swastika, a symbol from ancient times, the traditional meaning of which is the involutional driving force, or the principle of embodiment. It's form-based. That's why Hitler used this cross, which, interestingly, is made up of four fours. And if we write the fours this way, it gives us the square and the cross, the symbol of matter par excellence. This is literally and figuratively four squared, clearly showing that our character for the number four is based on geometry. The swastika with the arms pointing the other way represents the Shivic principle, the force that impels the jiva, or indweller, to re-identify with spirit. So we have, you know, two swastikas, one driving spirit into form, into embodiment, and one that allows us to move back towards spirit. So this this one is shown in Tibetan Buddhism like this and this, rather than like this. The complete system is depicted in ancient Orient, in this ancient Oriental figure, with the middle diameter representing the midway point, where the dual axes of the fourth ray and fourth subplane work in accord. And since the dual revolutions of the planes and the rays compel spirit into form, could it be that mounting the dual axes, another way of saying that is to mount the cross, mounting the dual axes of this great wheel, the fourth subplane, by means of the fourth ray, we as human beings, as disciples, can reverse our polarity and use this dual axes to compel us, in accordance with DK's descriptions of the directions, upwards and inward rather than downward and outward. If so, this dual revolution could be seen as a mechanism of enlightenment and suggests that when we pass between the pairs of opposites represented by the dweller on the threshold, which is just the personality, and the angel of the presence, we repolarize our chakras and thus move from the influence of the left-handed to the right-handed swastika. This journey is illustrated in the sequential unfolding of the greater arcana of the Tarot, but especially through the first two, the middle three, and the final arcanum. A variation on the word Tarot is rota, which means to rotate, thus associating the Tarot with the swastikas. In the sequence from zero to one, the fool becomes the white magician. For the white magician must eventually come to rule the personality, thus aligning with the midway point. To do this, our intrepid zero become one, like each of us, must pass through the midway point, where we will reverse the polarity of our higher and lower centers through the agency of the 10th arcanum, the great wheel. Notice the similarity to this figure. Notice the numbers here. The little one of the personality becomes the greater one, the soul, the self-realized magician, the tetractus. Now repolarized as 1-0, and thus in alignment with the 1-0 of the wheel, he is ready for the great reversal on the wheel of life, represented by Arcanum 11, Justice, which is Libra, holding the scale of balance, right? 10 arcana before and 10 after. Libra, you may remember, is also associated with reversal on one's passage through the 12 signs of the zodiac. Having successfully passed through the midway point, the newly initiated magician is then depicted in the 12th arcanum called the Hangman, representing spirit immersed in the world of form, or one immersed in two, hence the 12. You can see the cross legs represent the four of matter. Also, the red can be associated with matter. And the three of his arms crossed behind his back, which represents a triangle, represents the triple aspect of divinity. And the fact that he's reversed shows that it's spirit in the realm of form, or within the Tao, which is that the tree there in the shape of the Tao, which is a symbol for the material realm. Okay. This is three immersed in the four of form, which again brings to mind the tetrahedron, whose four triangles also add to 12. Both represent threeness, or the sacred, suspended in the realm of four. Finally, our journey culminates in the 21st arcanum, or two and one, yet another reversal, this time from the 12 of the hangman, where the perfected initiate stands free at the center of the four animal signs, which represent the fixed cross. 21 is both 3, the perfected triangle, and 3 times 7, which happens to be the number of subplanes in the higher three planes of the cosmic physical realm. The numbers in these tarot arcana are kind of interesting. 01 becomes 10 through the agency of the 10th arcanum. This 10th arcanum plus the arcanum 11, hub of the tarot arcana, add to 21, the number of the final arcanum. Arcanum 12 reversed is also 21. Finally, these six arcana numerologically add to 10, which reduces to 1, the number of the magician. And we've come rota, full circle, but on a higher evolutionary spiral. A point of focus leading to a point of tension, which inevitably leads to a point of crisis, which when overcome resolves into a new point of focus. Okay, this is a kind of Cliff's Notes journey through the tarot, which can be seen as the journey of the disciple from acolyte to adept. But let's get back to the four directions. Here's a passage from the old commentary. Could we get a reader for this? When you see the word blank in brackets, it means that the original reference was too occult to be given out, so you can just say blank, unless you know, of course, what that blank represents, and you can say that, but otherwise just say blank. We have any yes. Takers, any volunteers? Good.
Yes, we do. Please go ahead, Scott.
At the four corners of the square.
Whoa, wait a minute. Scott, you're breaking up pretty bad. Try it again.
At the four corners of the square.
Hold it. Could you unplug and replug in your headset?
Sure.
You might try like a different USB port or something to see if that helps.
How's this?
Yes. Great.
Okay. All righty. Let's see here. At the four corners of the square, the four angelic blank are seen. Orange they are, but veiled in rosy light. Within each form, the yellow flame is seen, and round each form, the blue blank. Four words they utter forth, one for each human race. From out the north, a word is chanted forth, which means blank, be pure. From out the south, the word peals out, I dedicate and blank. From out the east, bringing a light divine, the word comes swinging around the square, love all. From out the west, the answer is thrown back, I serve.
Thank you, Scott. This is one of the very few quotes that Dhaval Kul gives us with specific reference to the four directions, so it's worth some study in terms of the qualities related to the directions. So this quote, in conjunction with an earlier quote, the one we read earlier, led me to the following conclusions. See if you share my hypothesis. If not, raise your hand and we'll duke it out. Okay, north is a symbol for the direction upwards into kingdoms hitherto unseen and unknown. South is a symbol for the direction downwards into kingdoms which we call subhuman. East is a symbol for the direction inwards toward divinity itself. And west is a symbol for the direction outwards into the human environment and into the human kingdom. This isn't definitive, but seems a workable hypothesis. You know, altars are often placed facing east, inward towards divinity, or north, upwards into kingdoms hitherto unseen. Also, in Masonic lodges, for instance, there is an empty chair placed in the north, thus acknowledging the unseen higher kingdoms. So have I aroused anybody's alternate thoughts on this? Any challenges? No? Yes?
So far, no hands. So far, okay. No comments. So
okay, fine.
They're all still chewing on it.
All right. Okay, notice here that the symbol for the third logos depicted in the center, the third logos is the first to create in time and space, and thus has the same symbol used to describe the four directions in cultures throughout the world, even in New Mexico, the bottom right hand there. DK says, the true circle of matter is the equal arm cross of the Holy Spirit, who is the personification of active, intelligent matter. This symbol shows the fourth dimensional quality of matter and the penetration of the fire in four directions. Its threefold radiation being symbolized by the triangles formed by the fourfold cross. So what 3D figure do we know that is made up of four triangles? Okay. Connected on causal levels to the four directions are the four Lapika lords, said to be from Sirius. They are among the most exalted beings associated with our solar system. We're told that the first group, called the four Maharajas, applies past karma to humanity. They are whom we normally think of as the lords of karma. The second group, which DK describes, which is only contacted after the fourth initiation, applies to future karma, to the coming races. Now think about that a moment. The phrase future karma itself seems like an oxymoron, doesn't it? Since our usual understanding of karma is related to past deeds. DK tells us that the Lapika lords are special intimates of the logos, and eventually find their way, and I think that's the solar logos, and eventually find their way onto the path of absolute sonship. So, though these four great beings are not themselves found in the lower quaternary and what we normally think of as manifested realms, their sphere of activity deals with the lower quaternary. Okay, we've considered the tetrahedron, the cube, and the square as among the primary forms that carry within them qualities of fourness. For our final figure, expressive of the number four, let's consider the fixed cross, the one most relevant to discipleship, using DK's threefold method. Those of you who have been regularly attending these webinars know the drill. First, we start with a physical analysis. Could we get a reader for this instruction?
Come on, folks.
Just push your hands up button.
There we go. Go ahead, please, Iris.
Exoterically, this involves study of its form as a whole, of its lines and therefore of its numerical significance, and also study of its sectional forms, by which I mean its arrangements. Glamour, a world problem, AAB.
Thank you. So, what can we say about the lines, the numerical significance, and the arrangement of the forms that make up the fixed cross? At this point, we're not looking for meaning or significance, but simply a tabulation of this figure's physical attributes. We'll make a mental list, and we'd love to have you participate. When called on, please briefly describe a single physical attribute of this symbol. Your observations may seem obvious, like the ones listed here. That's fine. Any ideas that help us physically define these crosses are useful. Okay, I've started us off with two ideas. The cross contains a vertical and a horizontal line placed at 90 degree angles from each other. The larger cross contains a small equal armed cross at its center. So, any further observations? What other physical attributes do you see?
The horizontal line is not halfway down the vertical line. It's higher than the midpoint of the vertical line.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Actually, I measured this, and I'll get to those measurements. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not quite halfway, but it's very close to halfway. Yeah. Great. Who was that, by the way?
Not.
Malia.
Oh, I thought so. Okay. It's real close. I took it in a CAD program and measured it just to see. But we'll get there. Okay. Any other thoughts? Anything at all that you can say about this?
Go ahead, please, Scott.
The center of the circle and the crossing point of the large cross coincide.
Right. Yeah. Very important point, which suggests something about the circle. But we'll get into what it suggests in the second part of our analysis. Good. What else? You know, it's interesting. Sometimes the simpler forms, you know, we've analyzed the tetrahedron and the cube, and sometimes the simpler forms can be in some ways more difficult to really hone in on. So any other thoughts?
Go ahead, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. You might have to take your unmute off. Yes, if you look where there's a microphone and a line through it, if you click on that, you can unmute yourself.
I don't see a line through.
Oh, you don't see it.
But it could be muted on the headset.
Oh, yeah. There may be a button on your headset, Lynn.
No, not getting anything. Okay, let's go to another one and we'll come back.
Okay, anyone else?
Go ahead, please, Terry.
Lynn, by the way, sorry, Terry. Hang on a second, Terry. Lynn, since we're not able to hear you, why don't you type in the text box your point, and BL will get you on that. Okay, go ahead, Terry. How are you, by the way?
Fine, thanks. Good. Four right-angled triangles are displayed.
Yeah, that's right. Well, certainly... the upper two, but then if we make triangles down to the lower point, the angle changes, but nonetheless they are still right angled because they emanate from the center. And remember the quote where DK says that about the four triangles that are inherent in this. So thank you, Terry. Yes. Right. Any other thoughts?
Can you hear me? I got Lynn's comment. A vertical line seems to have a relationship with the golden ratio.
It's close. It's not quite there, but it is quite close. It's within about a 10% of it. Anybody else?
Yes, I got a couple of more comments. Laura Lee says the horizontal line represents the life of service.
Oh, wait a minute. Okay, that's a great comment, but it actually belongs in the second part of our analysis. This is strictly physical attributes. You know, there's a certain duh factor to the physical attributes, right? It's like what I just said. The cross contains a vertical and a horizontal line placed at 90-degree angles. I mean, it's so obvious that you may not even mention it. But that's the kind of thing in this phase of the analysis we're looking for. So hold on to that comment. We're going to be at the second part before you know it. So any other
and
thoughts?
Patricia says four 90-degree quadrants in the circle.
Mm-hmm. Correct. That's right. Four 90-degree quadrants. Yes. Okay. Anything else?
Please go ahead, Scott.
You could go with vertical. You do have the directions represented. It is seems to be in a north, south, east, west compass rose alignment.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, that's true. Thank you for that. Right.
And so, Yvonne says it's one-dimensional.
Two-dimensional, actually. Yeah. One dimension would be just a line. We're taken to two dimensions when we have other than a line. Am I right on that? You know, the circle itself is two-dimensional in that sense, right? The cross indicates two dimensions, even though, I guess, strictly speaking, what do you think of that, Scott? What would you say? Just a cross, no circle. Would it be a one-dimensional or two-dimensional? I mean, a one- or two-dimensional form? Since a point is considered no dimensions.
Right, a line is two. It's one.
A line is one.
Yeah. It doesn't make a figure. The circle makes the figure, but the lines don't.
Right. So maybe it is one.
Yeah.
So also, yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say also, there's the incommensurate pi figure that's involved in the circumference of the circle. So you have an irrational circumference of the circle.
Good point.
Versus measurable vertical and horizontal lines.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Hey, yeah, Francis, can I add something?
Sorry, BL, no. Yeah. No, go ahead, please. are a part of this.
I am so much not into geometry, but isn't it two-dimensional? It's got a length and a width?
Well, certainly the circle is, right? But one could argue that the cross without the circle doesn't actually have a width. It's just implied. If you were to draw any kind of bounding box around that cross. But you know what we need is a theoretical mathematician here to tell us, strictly speaking, but you know, I think it's, then we could move right on to counting angels on the heads of pins and stuff. We all understand the idea behind this, right? That one dimension, zero dimensions is a point because it has no dimensionality. One dimension is a line because it represents the first dimension. The second dimension is here indicated by the circle because it has both width and height, right? And then, of course, you move on to the third dimension when you take on depth, right? And CAD programs, it's X, Y, and Z, you know, where you have the third dimension. Anyway, I think we've got this idea down.
We have another comment and then another hand up. So Mark says four or eight 90-degree angles are formed.
Okay, so where do you, I'm interested, where do you get the 8?
Hold on a minute.
Oh, was this in, yeah, he wrote this, so we can't really have a dialogue. If he wants to answer how he gets the 8, I would be interested in knowing. Now, what I could extrapolate from that comment.
Ooh, we got some background noise, but can you go ahead, Mark?
Mark, can you speak? No, go ahead and cut him off. Okay. I'm going to say
Wait a minute. He's typing. The second four are inside the circle. Sorry, no microphone. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So the second four are inside the circle.
Right. And then the that's what I was going to say, that we're really looking at two crosses here, right? They're superimposed. So at least it can be seen that way. I'm not saying that that's the only way. It could be seen also as just one cross with a circle, right? But if you have two crosses superimposed, then yes, you have the 8 right angles that Mark mentions. Any other physical attributes before we move on?
Yes, Trudy has been patiently waiting, so go ahead, please, Trudy.
What is the significance of the vertical line being twice as long as the horizontal line?
What we'll do is I'm going to answer your question in the next phase of the analysis, which is the subjective phase. It deals with significance and meaning. At this point, we're just looking at the physical attribute, but we're going to be wrapping this up in a minute, so we'll get to your answer. That's where the juice is in the subjective, but just now we're looking at purely physical attributes. Any other comments about the physical attributes of this figure? Okay, here's some other ideas that I had, having quite a bit longer to contemplate it than you have. Except for the circle, two intersecting lines, like the cross, mark the simplest way to describe two-dimensional space. Of course, that gets back to the argument we just had, or the question we had about the one dimension versus two. The circle embraces a common center marked by the intersection of the two arms of the cross. That's the point that Scott brought up. The two lines of the fixed cross could also be seen as four lines, the three upper lines of which are of equal length, and the bottom longer lined. Now, I, too, assumed that the bottom section was twice the length of the upper ones. But I recreated this cross in a program that allows for precise measurement, wherein I discovered that the length of the vertical arm of the cross, which is illustrated in Discipleship in the New Age, is in a 7-to-4 ratio to the horizontal arm. For you theosophists, this has instant significance. Okay. On the vertical arm, two of these units stand above and five stand below the horizontal arm. Okay? All right. These four lines give us two pairs of opposites. If we look at it as two lines, it's a pair of opposites. The opposite being indicated by the fact that they're in 90-degree opposition. As in the cube, all the angles are 90 degrees. I think that was pointed out. If this figure were an orthogonal view of a 3D figure, it would represent a sphere within a rectangular cuboid. There's a second cross, an equal arm cross, within the small circle that was brought out. Both the inner and outer crosses are characterized by five points, four endpoints and one central point. If we include the points that mark the intersection of the small circle, the whole cross has 9 points. If we connect the left and right endpoints to the top point and remove the upper vertical arm and the circle, we have the cardinal cross, though the bottom leg becomes shorter, approximately the length of the horizontal. This bottom leg is approximately the length of the horizontal arm. Now, you know, I have no idea whether the precise measurements as given in discipleship in the New Age are, if they were intended to be precise in any way, but the fact that the fixed cross depicted on the left has a ratio of 4 to 7 suggests, and it was really, really close. I mean, it was basically right on. And by the way, for the person who suggested that this is in a golden mean ratio, the actual golden mean ratio is 3 to 5. Even that's not precise, but 4 to 7 gets you about 10% off. But nonetheless, it is close to that. Okay. There are 2 orthogonal views of the cross. Oh, you'll hear this word a lot in these webinars. Orthogonal just means a straight-on view from a different angle, right? So seen from above, we see a horizontal line. Seen from the side, we see a vertical line. You see how that would work? Okay. This is indicative this can take you into significance and meaning. And that's the whole point of this physical analysis, to stimulate our imaginations so that we might derive meaning and significance from the cross's physical attributes. So before we move on, does anyone see any other physical attributes? Did my list suggest any additional ones? Okay, if not,
let's move on.
Nobody's, okay, that's fine. We have enough. I think we got it covered. But if you get a real aha, I'm always interested to know. With that in mind, let's move to the next phase of our analysis. Could we get a reader for this second phase? And this is where we had two people that interjected the meaning and significance aspect of this. So we're now into that. Can we get a reader, please?
No
volunteers?
Hands.
No hands? Somebody will do it.
Doesn't matter if you've already read.
If anybody with a microphone, of course you might scare them off. Come
there
on,
we
folks.
Go. There we go.
Okay,
there
good.
We go.
All right.
Please go ahead, Rosanna.
Thank you, Ron. Rosanna.
There you go.
Hello.
Hi.
All right. Conceptually, hi.
Go ahead. Hello, we hear you.
All right, thank you. Conceptually, this involves arriving at its underlying idea, which may be expressed in its name, at its meaning as that emerges in the consciousness through meditation, and at its significance as a whole or in part. You should, when doing this, bear in mind that the idea connotes the higher or abstract intent, that the meaning is that intent expressed in terms of the concrete mind, and that its significance has in it more of an emotional quality and might be expressed as the type of desire it arouses in you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So DK ascribes meaning to the concrete mind and significance to the emotional realm. So considering our list of physical attributes, these are just the ones I came up with, and you had a few additional significant ones. One in particular that I missed is that the circle introduces the idea of a irrational, which I prefer to call transrational, number through pi, right, which is an attribute of spirit. So that definitely should be on this list. So just peruse this list and see if anything jumps out in terms of meaning. If we had time, we could literally go down every point on this list and derive a physical meaning from it. Here's a couple of examples. The use of the cross to represent the intersection of spirit and form is found in many spiritual disciplines and philosophies, not only in Christianity. In fact, the cross as a spiritual symbol long predates Christianity. You can find examples in art of it way before the time of the Christ. Okay, the circle could be seen as the ring pass not of the central point. So, those are a couple of seeding thoughts, simple as they are. Do we have any further ideas about the meaning and or significance of the fixed cross? As you're thinking about this, try to use our list of physical attributes as the basis for your ideas, or not. Any thoughts about the...
Nothing yet. They're thinking.
Now, let me pull the cross back up here so you can...
Here we go.
Consider it. Yeah.
Let's go with... Go ahead, please, Scott.
The fact that it's not an equal arm cross, the large cross, does have a feeling of being drawn down into matter. There's an extension from the upper, you might call it the tau, the three arm cross, equal armed, down into form, into a lower realm, perhaps the south. And that's, so there is a feeling of the crucifixion here of spirit descending.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, and if you know if what we know about the fixed cross in terms of astrology supports your idea. You know, this is the cross of the disciple. This is what we mount in order to serve. Any other thoughts?
Yes, Malia says the presence of the circle introduces the feminine principle. And
yes.
Then Orest has a comment. Please go ahead, Orest. You're on self-mute. We can't hear you.
Hi, Orest.
There you
I
go.
I know you're alone.
The circle represents a sphere, and the sphere is like a point of focus, and its point of focus is at a point of intersection. So it's at a particular point where it is held.
Yes. You know, it's interesting. The sphere is considered a symbol for a unit of consciousness, right?
Cool.
Whether it be an atom or a man or a solar logos, right? Both the atom and the planets and suns actually take the form of spheres. And our own auras, when seen... from the point of view of the higher realms also is more like an ovoid or more sphere-like. Anyway, so as this unit of consciousness, it could represent that unit of consciousness which has mounted the fixed cross, right? So thanks for that, Arrest. And yes, I wanted to comment on your idea, which didn't occur to me at all, the concept of the feminine and the masculine. That's very interesting. You know, the ultimate curvilinear form is, in fact, the circle, and by extension, the sphere. And you could say the ultimate masculine form is, in a sense, this strong delineation of the cross. So it's interesting when we look at those two in conjunction, what is that telling us? You know, it suggests a hermaphroditic or masculine-feminine combination, that which stands within, you could say, both principles. Because remember, what do the circle and the cross have in common? That central point. So, okay, other thoughts?
Yes, Christina says, wait a minute, first, Lynn. Outer points of cross seem to form a, and I'm not going to say this right, vesica pisces?
Vesica pisces, that's close.
Okay. And then Christina says, within the circle is the equal armed cross, and the point is at the center where the cross intersecting, which is the oneness contained within the endless circumference. From the beginning of this, we involute into matter. The soul is present at the center, ever present, even as we come into matter, outward beyond the circle.
Yes, thank you for that. This takes us to one of the most profound meanings represented here, which is that point of crossing, which is both of the circle, that is, it orients both the circle and the cross, represents something that is really beyond either. It's almost like a portal that takes you beyond the consciousness represented by this fixed cross. And it certainly is the concept of unity, right? It's the oneness. The circle, and from this point of view, could be seen as a kind of aura of that central point, right? So yeah, thanks for that. Any other?
Yes, we have a couple of hands up. Okay, please go ahead, Scott.
Okay, the circle is the perfect form. It's the ideal form, and within it is the perfected equal arm cross. Extending out of that is the cross, fixed cross, which is not yet equal arm. It's extended down. And when it becomes an equal arm cross, as the ideal suggests in the center, then the work is done.
That's beautifully said. Yes, indeed. We could extrapolate from Scott's comment that what we're looking at is a combination of the soul and personality. That is, the soul working through the personality, and not only in service, but as a means of transforming that personality. And at the fourth initiation, interesting, with the four arms of the equal cross, of the four equal arm cross, the fourth initiation, you could say that you would just be left with the circle with the cross. It's also the symbol of the third aspect of divinity, or the third logos. So yes, it's beautifully said. Thank you. Anything else?
Yes. We have a comment from Malia. This form is also the pared-down version of the Celtic cross, which opens up all kinds of symbolism.
Yes, it does indeed. If you want to explore the nature of the fixed cross, Google Celtic cross, and it will take you into a world of meaning just in that. Thank you, Malia. Other thoughts?
Yes, go ahead, please, Terry.
It's just a fairly banal point, but I think perhaps one ought to add that a cross does mean suffering. And this is one of the basic factors, it seems, that is part of the intentions of the Sanat Kumara. Why is humanity bound up with suffering? And I think one sees it in the symbol of the cross.
That's absolutely true. We suffer on one of three crosses, and this is the middle of those three, the fixed cross. And we'll actually be getting to the other two crosses a little later on in the webinar. Absolutely right. It is. One of the aspects of the cross is suffering. No doubt about it. Other comments?
Yes. Please go ahead, Arrest. You're on self-mute.
The axis can be seen three-dimensionally, for example, as the corner of a cube, and then the circle would be a sphere. So the sphere is contained or held by the axis lines. So the feeling of containment within a realm is suggested.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, you know, as I mentioned before, this is actually an orthogonal view of a three-dimensional figure, or can be seen that way, which is that it would be the cube containing, because the cube is longer and taller. A cuboid is the actual mathematical phrase. I didn't know that before I looked it up, by the way. Containing a small sphere two-fifths the way down from its surface. So that's a fascinating. I wanted to recreate this in a 3D program, but I didn't get around to it. I think it's a fascinating combination.
My second point is the suggestion of a kite when you draw up the lines, and then again you have the symbolism of the kite itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And what does the kite symbolize for you, Orest?
Flight.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Borne up by air. Yeah. Okay. Great. Other thoughts, ideas on the meaning and significance?
That's all I see. No more hands.
That's
no
it? Okay. I'm going to, because, you know, time goes so fast, I'm going to go ahead with my list. Remember DK telling us that the underlying idea may be expressed in the name? Well, the word cross is itself suggestive. Among the verbs, common dictionary definitions of to cross include to traverse, span, and bridge. Secondly, to intersect, meet, and join. And finally, to oppose, resist, or defy. And if we had time, we could probably have a 30-minute discussion on this point alone, just in the nature of, for instance, how the fixed cross allows us to span or traverse from the personality to the level of the soul. The nouns related to the cross fall into two categories. The first is the idea of burden, trial, or tribulation, which Terry suggested in the idea of pain and agony, right? And the second meaning is to mix or blend, right? Which is directly indicated, of course, by the two arms of the cross. Now, potentially, all these definitions have an occult significance. Okay, the number four in conjunction with the central point has to do with the heart center, the fourth and middle center in the etheric body. Thus, the cross is an appropriate symbol for the Christ, the avatar of love. But the position of the circle and the vertical arm is 2/7 down from the top, which would be in the position of the Ajna center. You know, if we give 1/7 to each center, then 2 down from the top would be the head center at the top, and then the Ajna center, right? So that's an interesting perspective on the cross. In fact, the fact that we're looking at 7 divisions, which is defined by the 4 of the horizontal, opens up an entirely series of related concepts to the subplanes of any given plane, right? In which case, the arm of the cross would be at the bottom edge of the second subplane. Okay. The cross could be seen as a symbol for a number of sacred texts. For example, this old time, from this old commentary, which states that may the energy of the divine self inspire, that's the vertical arm, and the light of the soul direct, right? At the center of these two streams, and thus the center of the cross, stands every true server, or unit of consciousness, as we were discussing earlier, you know, receiving the divine inspiration from above, through the top half of the vertical cross, and then the scope of the service being indicated by the light of the soul, the directing of the light of the soul, right? And then the downward arm, as Scott suggested, the grounding, the fact that, you know, if this is seven subplanes, we're looking at earthly existence here. Okay.
All right, we have a comment here.
Good.
From Laura Lee.
Hi, Laura Lee. Go ahead.
Within the circle, the horizontal and the vertical lines of the cross are equal length. If the horizontal line represents the life of service and the vertical line represents the line of spiritual contact, then the equal armed cross within the circle could indicate that the disciple must balance the life of service with his spiritual practices of meditation, etc.
Yes. Yeah, and in fact, all aspects of balance are represented by this cross within the circle, aren't they? It's a terrific symbol for the balancing of not only of reception and outpouring, but spirit and matter in general. Thank you for that. Okay.
We have a hand up.
Yeah.
Please go ahead, Asha.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Going on from what the previous person just said and the original first piece that we had written that I wrote about, I was also thinking along the same lines that the vertical represents the I, the individual, the me. I mean, it could, just, you know, mm-hmm. kind of teasing it out a little bit, just, mm-hmm. and then the horizontal is the service to others, it's kind mm-hmm. of, and so, as the previous person said, you know, you've got the study and the contemplation, and then you've got the service. So, the mm-hmm. first quote where DK mentions, although he talks about dissonance, when one is using the creative forces to oneself, rather than serving others, that is something I've not ever been able to really understand. That was why my question was, I have to listen to the replay. I didn't fully get your reply, Francis.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, serving oneself is really a question of it's whether you have this S capitalized or not.
Right.
If you're serving that which you are identified with. And so if you're identified with the personality, it becomes what's called self-service, right? Which is just another way of saying selfishness, right? If you're serving soul, if you're identified with soul, then DK actually defines service as simply soul contact. It's not about doing stuff. You can volunteer all day long. If you're not connected with the soul, it's not true service because you're not bringing light into the world. And if you're doing nothing at all, but you're connected with your soul, then you're grounding the light of the fifth realm in this place called the earth. So just wherever you are, you're in service. So it's helpful to kind of uncouple this idea of service as a function of doing, though certainly someone who is soul-infused and is acting at the behest of his soul certainly is going to be active, you know, not just reflective. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts? Okay, let's move on here. If we use the arms of the cross to represent the space, the time-space continuum, the point where they meet could represent that which lies beyond or within time and space, the center which is everywhere, and right, the circumference nowhere and the center which is everywhere, that kind of an idea. Okay. It is also the sacred tree from which hangs the hangman, the four of form and the three of spirit representing the two arms of the cross. Because of its strict adherence to the vertical and horizontal axes, no other 2D form is as strongly conditioned by polarity. But unlike the cube, which is also expressive of duality, the cross has a central point, which can be seen as a point of release. Now, the cube has a central point, but it has to be found, and the way you find it is by drawing a cross through the center. So it's interesting to think in terms of the what the cross is in relation to the cube in that way, from the point of view of consciousness. Okay, the equal arm cross, yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry. You have another comment here from Gabriel. Is the cross within the circle the symbol of the earth?
Yes, it certainly is. And I actually mentioned that in one of my points. So you're correct. It is the astrological symbol of the earth. And I'll be mentioning that in a moment. Thank you. Okay, the eagle arm cross enclosed by a circle. Here we are. Okay. Is the astrological glyph of the earth. Oh, I just love synchronicity. And could thus be seen as a symbol for Sanat Kumara's ongoing sacrifice. Because remember, he is incarnate. It's just etherically. But he has for untold eons been with us, literally. And if you don't think that's a sacrifice for one of his, what we don't even know what level of consciousness he is in his own personal, if you can use such a word, evolution. For such a one to be incarnate on the etheric levels is, you know, the greatest ongoing sacrifice of all. Okay. Whereas a tetrahedron can be seen as a triple radiation of four points, and the cube an expression of polarity, the cross emphasizes both the line, the pairs of opposites, and the point. For this reason, it is a fit symbol for crucifixion, quote, the cross upon which the inner spiritual man is to be crucified. This is brought out by a number of you at different points. In fact, we could hypothesize that the three figures are progressive. The cross is inherent but unmanifest in the cube, and the tetrahedron is inherent but unmanifest in the four triangles implied by the arms of the cross. That's a point that Terry brought forth, right? You could say that the cube has the potential of the cross within it, and the cross has the potential of the tetrahedron, which is made up of four. It's completely expressive of the energy of the equilateral triangle, but because of its fourfold nature, it's within the realm of form. Okay, so you may remember from last time that the cross, as well as the cube and the line, are one of the nine, the cross is one of the nine symbols that every disciple must master before becoming an initiate. So I'd like to repeat what DK says, right, I'd actually like one of you to read this section that describes the importance, it really underscores the incredible importance of the kind of study that we're doing here. Can we get a reader for this, please?
No hands yet. Come on. Let's have a volunteer, please. There we go. Please go ahead, Elizabeth.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you for volunteering. Are you self-muted? Maybe your headset might have a mute button on it that you could turn off.
We can't hear you.
Okay, try somebody else.
Okay. Please go ahead, Asha.
All these symbols, allied, interwoven, or taken in part, are combined to express one or other of the seven secrets of initiation. The initiate has to recognize them by sight as well as to hear them, and by an effort of the will to imprint them irrevocably upon his memory.
Thank you. Thank you, Asha. So, what do you think it's like to hear the note or chord of the fixed cross? What would that sound like? Okay. Any additional observations about the subjective nature of the cue before we move on?
No, I don't see any hands or comments.
Okay. I think we've got some good sense of the potential understanding, the significance and meaning of this figure. So with that, let's move into the third phase of DK's analysis. And I'd like a reader for this. Please. Actually, I'll just go ahead and read this. We seem to have a dearth of readers today for some reason. Okay, C is esoterically. This would cover the effect of the force or energy upon you and of the quality of the vibration it may arouse in you, perhaps in some center, perhaps in your astral body, or perhaps only in your mind. Okay, so having familiarized ourselves with the fixed cross, let's seize the moment and reflect on where in ourselves it affects us. Keep in mind as you visualize that symbols and geometric figures, rather than being descriptions of potencies, are inherently potent. Thus, they have the potential to penetrate and reveal. This calls for visualization. So we'll take exactly 1 minute for this meditation on the fixed cross. You can do it with either eyes open or closed, starting now. Okay, now let's widen our scope to also include the other two crosses often spoken by DK. During this webinar series, we've considered the cardinal, fixed, and mutable crosses in relation to the number 1, 2, and 3. Now let's take a look at how they work sequentially as three manifestations of one process. If you don't think there's a cross active in your life, listen up. DK gives us two sets of illustrations depicting the three crosses. The cross most associated with form, the mutable cross, is called the cross of the hidden Christ. This is also, as you can see, indicated by an X. At this stage, the arms of the cross represent that which prepares a person for aspiration. These four energies create what DK calls conditioning circumstances, circumstances characterized by change, by rapid oscillations between the pairs of opposites, hence its mutable nature. The agony of this cross, remember Terry told us that crosses are agonizing, comes through the conflict generated by the personality. This is the stage where the influence of the cube dominates. The second cross, which we just analyzed, is called the cross of the crucified Christ, and also the cross of right direction. Experience on this cross is increasingly distinguished by fixed vision and immovable intent, hence its name, the fixed cross. The disciple who is on this cross becomes increasingly identified with the solar principle. The agony associated with the fixed cross comes first in the form of personality reaction to soul alignment, and then, especially in the later stages, from the reaction from the disciple's environment. That which the response to the disciple from his environment. This continues until the fourth initiation. At the end of initiation human and solar is an old commentary entitled Archive 13 that describes the experience of the fixed cross. Gabrielle, you probably don't have a microphone, but I would like you to, let's see what kind of ambient noise is created when you try to read this. If it's too much, we'll back off, but could you give this a try?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Oh, you're perfectly clear.
Oh, good. The arms that form the cross become the great dividing line, placed twixt the lower and the higher. Upon those arms the hands are nailed, the hands that grasp and hold, ministering to the lower needs, trained thus through many eons. Lo, when the hands are helpless held, and cannot grasp and hold, the inner life slips from its sheath, mounting the limb upright. It passeth from the lower forth, and the cross doth bridge the gap. Man then indeed becomes the cross.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. You're on the hook from now on because without a microphone, you seem to be still perfectly clear. Oh, and we may do some experimenting with other folks that way too, because I'd like to have more participation. Thank you, Gabrielle.
Francis.
Yeah.
Speaking of participation, you have a comment here from Christina.
Great.
Bringing light from heaven to earth and outward to others, while protected by the endless circumference, we risk and come into form, and from soul we allow this release, as long as we center.
Nicely said. Thank you. Okay. Let's move on to the third cross. Third cross is called the cross of the risen Christ and the beginning of the endless way of revelation. The initiate's experience on this cross starts with that stage of consciousness called nirvana. The cardinal cross is experienced as a cross because for one so enlightened, just being in the realm of time and space, it's itself a kind of crucifixion. DK tells us, it is the cross of the widespread arms, the open heart and the higher mind, for those who lie upon the cross, for those who lie upon this cross, know and enjoy the significance underlying the words omnipresence and omniscience, and are in process of unfolding the higher phases of being, which we inadequately cover by the word omnipotence. The geometry of the cardinal cross, with the fourth extending down from the three, suggests the tetrahedron, which is also three in the realm of four. You know, I begin to sound like a used car salesman with this tetrahedron, but I've come to see it as the very highest three-dimensional form that is extant. Okay, the entire journey represented by the three crosses is described in this old commentary from esoteric astrology. Okay, I'd like to have two volunteer readers, one each for sections 2 and 3 of this. I'll read section 1. So we need a couple of readers. If you've been regularly attending and you don't have a microphone, let's do an experiment like I did with Gabrielle to see if we can have you read without feedback. Would somebody without a microphone or a headset like to volunteer?
I have some hands up, but I think they have headsets.
It's all the people. That's all right. Ultimately, that's all right. But I would like to. I know I'm waking you from a deep sleep, but in terms of speaking during the webinars. But it would be great to not have you cut out just by the fact that you don't have a headset. If there's not that much interference or ambient noise. Anybody? I just gave you another minute to summon the courage to raise your hand. Do we have any?
I have a new name. I'm not sure if she has or hasn't. I got a heads up.
Oh, that is another.
Let's try
a new
speaker.
Name.
Okay. Go ahead, please, Alex.
Okay. Wait a minute. Before you speak, let's have you read the second section, which will be after I read this. It'll be the next screen that comes up, and then we need a third volunteer, or a second volunteer, I should say, for the last section. Do we have another volunteer?
We do. How about Christina? So
sounds
we'll do
great.
You first, and then Alex, and then Christina.
Okay. As the screens come up, just speak your part. Okay, the first one. The cross of many changes continues with its whirling, carrying crucified thereon the form of a man in whom is found the seed of all illusion.
But, can you hear me?
Yes.
But, from the cross whereon he has been slain, e'en though he knew it not, the man climbs down and feels his way, with pain and many tears, onto another cross, a cross of blinding light, of fiery pain, of bitter woe, and yet the cross of liberation. It's a stationary cross, fixed in the heavens, and guarded by the angel.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Behind the cross, another cross appears, but that he may not reach, the angel guards the way until the bull has rent and torn the man, and then the light shines forth. Until the serpent, dread, has wrestled with the man and brought him to his knees, and then the lifting up into the light until the lion has been tamed. The secret of the Sphinx revealed, and then the revelation of the inner light until the man has lifted up his water pot and joined the ranks of those who are the water bearers, and then the flowing of the stream of life will fill his water pot and drain the rancid pool and cleanse its source and thus reveal the hidden way which leads unto the innermost light hid by the final cross. Then from the cross of man, the initiate finds his way, passes the angel and leaves behind the inner torn veil, mounts the major cross, and passes into day, the final day. The wheel for him stands still, the sun and stars for him fade out, a great light is seen, and...
Dot, dot, dot. Kind of makes you want to achieve this level of consciousness just to see what happens next, doesn't it?
Yes.
Thank you, readers. Okay, we've seen four manifesting through two distinct but related concepts, the imprisoning cube, controlled by the lunar lords, and the potentially liberating midway point, which is very much associated with the fixed cross, the cube associated with the cross represented by the swastika and the X called the mutable cross. Okay. Yellow, the color associated with the fourth ray, expresses the energy of this midway point, and thus is associated with the fixed cross, which on the cosmic physical plane is the Buddhic plane, this fourth plane, called by DK the goal of humanity. So that wide band you see in the middle is the Buddhic plane. This is a chart of the seven planes of existence. The bottom section is the physical, astral, mental, then the Buddhic in the middle, and the three higher planes. On this plane, we're told yellow is an expression of electrical force. For color is the fourth expression of electricity. Its three higher expressions are electricity as vibratory impulse, electricity as light, and electricity as sound. So when George Carlin said electricity is really just organized lightning, he was closer to the truth than he probably knew. Of course, you never know about George. All right, when discussing the rays, we sometimes forget that these rays actually express themselves through the qualified electrical potency of the colors associated with the rays. Let me say that again. We forget that these rays actually express themselves through the qualified electrical potency of the colors associated with each ray. So these are not just pretty colors. They're specific, that is to say, they have a particular quality that carries an electrical potency that affects us. We're so used to the decorative and artistic use of color that it becomes difficult for us to comprehend a statement like indigo is the goal of endeavor. Healers have begun to discover the qualified electrical power of color, but as a science, healing through color is still just among the very few. It's as a broad science, it's in its infancy. We'll see that come out much more in the Aquarian age. We're told that yellow is the exoteric counterpart to indigo. In this regard, it's interesting to note that the pharaonic headdress of ancient Egypt were made of alternating bands of indigo or deep blue and gold. And letters on, you know, that we have the esoteric and exoteric counterparts in alternating patterns. In Letters on Occult Meditation, we're told that the deep blue is the color of the higher mental plane. Thus, the two alternating colors of these headdresses form a kind of resonating frequency between the higher mental and the Buddhic plane, between the inner and the outer realms. Well, at least outer for someone of this exalted state. The Egyptians were almost certainly aware of this esoteric quality of color and were thus working far beyond the merely decorative in their choice of colors. Imagine the effect of such a headdress designed by one initiate and worn by another. DK tells us that yellow develops and protects. It ensheathes the nucleus. It's interesting to note in this regard that the dominant color of the inner sacrificial triad of petals of the egoic lotus is yellow. Since the Buddhic plane is the goal of humankind, it's not surprising to discover that yellow carries the energies of completion and fruition. DK says, note how in autumn, when the processes of nature have run their course and the cycle is complete, the yellow of the autumn is spread upon the landscape. Note also that when the sun pours unimpeded down, the yellow of the harvest is to be seen. So it is in the life of the spirit, when the fourth plane of harmony or of Bodhi is achieved, then is consummation. When the work of personality is completed, and when the sun of the microcosm, the ego, pours unimpeded down into the personal life, then comes fruition and harvest. The at-one-ment, or the harmonizing, has been made, and the goal has been reached. So we'll end this survey of gold and yellow by noting that the pupils of the planetary school on Mercury, a fourth ray sacred planet, are called the sons of aspiration, or the points of yellow light. And we're told they have a close connection with our Earth scheme, which is referred to in this old commentary. Bodhi and Mercury correspond with each other, and both are yellow and radiant golden colored. The points of golden flame merge and blend with the four-leaved plants of tender green and change its color to a tinge of autumn yellow. Okay, let's see. All right, I'm going to push through. We're going to end a few minutes late, but if you don't mind, I'd like to finish this. There's a numerical relationship to be noted here. It says, oh, wait a minute. Sorry. Okay, let's take a closer look at the fourth ray and see if we can relate it to what we've learned over these past few months about the number four. Possibly the most distinctive characteristic of the fourth ray is, as DK says, in esoteric astrology, that it governs humanity as a center in the body of the planetary logos. He tells us, the fourth ray is the ray par excellence which governs humanity. There is a numerical relation to be noted here. For the fourth creative hierarchy of human monads, the fourth ray in this fourth round on the fourth globe, the Earth, are extremely active. It is their close interrelation and interplay which is responsible for the emergence into prominence of humanity. So he says, there's a numerical relationship to be noted here, suggesting that the inherent energy of fourth ray allows for this interplay between the hierarchy of human monads, the fourth round, and the fourth globe. In fact, that quality that we call interplay is a characteristic of the fourth ray. Interplay leads to alignment, which inevitably creates, in the course of a disciple's evolution, a crisis characterized by isolation and despairing futility, these are DK's words, but is eventually met by the determination to stand amidst what appears to be that which is impossible to overcome. In this standing, we are told, one comes to recognize the warrior within. In fact, the one who stands becomes a warrior when the inner master is able to express itself through the personality. We can see that inner master is the soul. According to Esoteric Psychology 1, the stream of energy that enables the warrior to effectively engage the form world is the intuition, which we can only access by employing the fourth ray of harmony through conflict, which in turn allows us to build the Antahkarana. This leads to uniquely fourth ray style triple victory for spirit, for form, and for the one, the warrior, who stands at the center. For you astrologers, you can see the strong scorpionic aspect to this. This warrior is characterized by steadfastness, the key word of the fourth ray. We can see from this why humanity is governed by and could not evolve without the influence of the fourth ray, which is interesting in the light of the fact that a new fourth ray cycle will, quote, slowly come into manifestation after 2025. So we can expect to see a marked intensification of soul light expressing itself in the lower quaternary sometime after 2025. Of course, it's already starting. It's not like we cross some line and it's altogether different. Okay, that's it for today. I hope you've enjoyed the webinar. Next month we'll begin our survey of the number, of the number five. The reading list remains the same. It is The Key to the Universe by Harriet and Homer Curtis. The chapter's on the number five. That'll prepare you for the next webinar. And the chapter's on the number five in A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe by Michael Schneider, for those of you who are following along on those. For today's meditation, I'd like to lead you in a guided visualization using an old commentary from the Rays and Initiations called The Chalice.
Okay, hold it just a second.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, a couple of comments here. From Stephen, I have followed all of the Sacred Geometry webinar presentations. I appreciate very much the personal efforts and work that Francis Donald has contributed to the contemplative suggestiveness of the numbers. From Asha, brilliant, awesome, thank you. And from Christina, thank you. So, okay, go ahead with your meditation.
Well, thank you all three. It's a great privilege for me to be able to offer this. Okay, so this old commentary is called The Chalice. And we'll begin with an om. You can, since everyone's on self-mute, feel free to om with me. Chalice. The lower chalice rises like a flower of color, dark or somber. Dull it appears to the outer vision, but within a light will sometimes shine and shatter the illusion. Chalice the second rises from out the lower sheath, as does the flower from out the calyx green. Of color rose it is, and many shades thereof, and to the onlooker it seems as if the color might transcend the inner shining light, but this is but illusion, which time itself dispels. Chalice the third surmounts all and opens wide in time its outspread petals. Blue does it appear and blends with the rose, forming at first a deep impenetrable shade which shuts out the light. Within the three, deep hidden in the heart, tiny at first, yet ever waxing greater, shines the light divine. This light, through radiating heat and innate divine vibration, constructs for itself a sheath of iridescence. It emerges from the threefold chalice as a floating bubble alights on a flower. Within this iridescent sheath burns the inner flame, and in its turn it burns out the lower gross material. E'en as the path is neared, clearer the light shines out, forth through the chalice growths and dark that forms the foundation, shines the light supernal, till all who see the radiation cry out within themselves, "Behold, a god is here." Forth from the chalice rosy red shines the inner glow, till soon the red of earth desire becomes the glow of heaven's fire. And all is lost save aspiration that shades not the cup with karmic color. Forth from the chalice blue shines and glows the inner light divine, till all the forms are burnt and gone, and naught is left save one divine abstraction. Naught but the shells remain below, naught but the form for use, and at the culmination, what strange event is seen? Tarry, O pilgrim, at the strange appearance, with bowed head, watch the progress of the fire. Slowly the chalice threefold merges into an altar, and from that triple altar mounts the fire unto its source. As mounts and spreads the inner flame, the beauty of the central sphere, lit with radiance white, causes the worlds to stand and cry, "Behold, a god is here." Ever the flame mounts higher, ever the warmth streams forth, till, in the moment of the hour set, the flame destroys all, and all is gone. The work of ages passes in a moment into nothingness. But forth from the fourfold fire, up from the altar of the ages, springs the liberated one, the flame. Back to the fire of cosmos springs the dual flame. Into the three is absorbed the essence and becomes one with its source. The spark becomes the flame. The flame becomes the fire and forms part of the great cosmic blaze that holds the secret of the five hidden within the heart. Okay, that's it for today. Don't forget to throw a couple of bucks at the Moria Federation. You can do that by going to moriafederation.com. This will help pay for this GoToMeeting account that we're using monthly. And that's what makes these webinars possible. Thanks to Brett, these webinars are available on makara.us, makara.us. You can find the previous 10 webinars at this point. Thank you, BL, for your assistance. You make my work so much easier. And finally, keep spreading the word about these webinar series. Love to see it full to overflow, if that was possible. Okay, thanks for attending. Our next webinar, which is always on the third Sunday, will be on June 21st, a very auspicious day. That's the day of the summer solstice. Okay, so bye for now.